seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 050956, James Vandevender versus Mitch Ward.
May it please the court, Mr. Gershon, the petitioner has 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, we all agree that salary benefits in Article 3, Section 52E end at the term the deputy's term ends. The issue today is, does the Constitution require an additional limit to these salary benefits that they only apply to the term in which the injury actually occurs? To sort that out, where do we have to begin? The language of the statute, the language of the constitutional amendment. And I'd like to begin with that to very briefly walk the court through the three provisions of Article 3, Section 52. Clause 1, of course, and we have a handout, provides that if a county has the ability, they're not required to, but they have the ability to pay medical bills if a law enforcement officer, if they are injured in the course of their official duties. Secondly, if there is an on-the-job injury and there is some hospitalization or incapacity, the county must pay the maximum salary, not a percentage of the percentage, the maximum salary, during that period of hospitalization and incapacity. Clause 3 is if there is any such hospitalization or incapacity and salary benefits are being paid, those cannot extend past the term of the deputy's term of office. So no one claims that this is benefits for life or permanent benefits, as they say in their brief. If a sheriff or deputy is so seriously injured, benefits are still only going to last through the end of that term of employment as long as they are employed.
So just bring us up to date. Is Mr. Vandevender is now not getting salary?
That's correct.
So that ended at the end of 2004?
Yes, Your Honor. And we have a little chronology to pull the dates out of the record in brief.
So when does the payments, which you say are required by the Constitution for a certain length of time, when do they end? What if the injury lasts for the life of the person 50, 60 more years,
sure,
you say?
They end at the date that that person is no longer deputized by the county and by the sheriff, which is a date that they themselves control. If Vandevender or anyone from the cases, as you know, is not reappointed by the sheriff and they're still injured, their benefits cut off then. If someone is injured or gets re-injured but is reappointed, is serving the county taxpayers, is being put in harm's way for an additional term, the benefits end at the end of that term.
Well, you said put in harm's way. I mean, from my perspective, these officers are always put in harm's way when they're out there doing their jobs. What difference does that make if they get hurt from the day, first day that they're appointed to the last day? It seems to me that if you read the statute, it gives the county reason to terminate them because they don't want to be responsible for continuing injury.
Well, as you know, they do make the argument, threaten may not be the right word, but it's the first word that comes to mind, that I'm going to give these officers extra scrutiny. Anybody's been hurt on the job and their term is coming to an end, I'm going to give them extra scrutiny. I may not reappoint them. But that's not an Article 52E issue. That's a democracy issue. A sheriff in that situation is left with two choices. Choice number one is, I'm not going to reappoint, as you say, any deputy that's been injured on the job because I don't want to bear the risk of some future expense. May not ever happen, but it may, and I don't want to bear that expense. I don't care how good you are, right? And that's a democracy issue. If the county wants to have the Florida Marlins of law enforcement, right, we just want green rookies. We don't want any extra expenses from people who have experience.
Did you say the Florida Marlins?
Yes.
They've won two World Series.
Exactly, and then you know what happens. They don't keep them. They got to start again.
If they don't reappoint them, do their workers' comp benefits keep going? I assume they're under the same workers' comp.
Of course, which sort of cuts both ways because they would still have this financial disincentive. They still are on the hook for some future exposure. But on the other side of the mix, if a sheriff chooses to have deputies around who are totally walking wounded, they can't do their job, then we're in the same position as the sheriff who decides, I just want my buddies on the force, right? And I don't care if they can or can't do their job. Again, that's a democracy issue. A department of Barney Fifes or nephews is not an Article 52E issue. The statute, the amendment, requires, says us, benefits through the end of the term that they're appointed.
Does it make any difference that this injury, that the when he was when the injury remanifested itself, does it make any difference that it related back to the injury from the prior term? Because it seems to me like there'd be no question here if he had a new injury that he would be entitled to maximum salary benefits. So is he somehow getting dinked that his incapacity now relates back?
Of course. It's a double dink. It's if it relates back, you get dinked. And then, of course, we have a causation argument that never got reached by the Court of Appeals. But totally, if it was a totally new injury with required another surgery, I don't think there would be any dispute. But the fact that it's a previous injury, if you're shot once and then you have a complication from that, you're being denied if you have a complication in a later term of office.
So from the beginning of the second term to March of 2001, he was working full-time, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so he received no 52E benefits, really, during that time. That was his salary, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And then, for whatever it's worth, he actually received 52E benefits for about another year after that, as the record shows.
Let me ask you about the procedural posture of the case. The trial judge did not find in your favor on the causation issue.
We're losers.
Yeah, and so you appealed that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I suppose you challenged the factual, what amounts to a factual sufficiency challenge.
Yes.
That the trial court's failure to find in your favor was against the great weight and preponderance.
And some other causation arguments as well, but of course.
And the Court of Appeals didn't reach those issues.
We're still losers.
Yeah. Ordinarily, the courts are reluctant to decide difficult constitutional issues when you could dispose of the case on an evidentiary review. Because if the Court of Appeals found against you on that, that would be the end of the case. Did the Court of Appeals indicate why they didn't reach the evidentiary issue?
Just what stated in opinion, they felt they didn't have to.
Right.
And so I understand sort of the issue of the time commitment of this court, and have sort of two reasons why the court needs to continue deciding this issue.
But in that, and in answering that, given those, why shouldn't the case just go back for an answer to the evidentiary question so that we continue our prudential reasons for not reviewing constitutional issues if we don't have to?
Well, of course, the county doesn't argue that. We've all agreed this is a good use of the court's time.
Right.
More importantly, if the court voted against us on either issue, I could see that sort of being the case. But here, we have an opinion now published on the books that says this is the way 52E works. It conflicts with the Van Sickle case, and so it's not our choosing, of course, to be up here bugging you, but we now have a decision on the books that answers the constitutional question, and we think it answers it wrong. We're going to have to go back and prove up causation or take care of the issue about if it's a new injury, then why don't we get benefits that way? But we've never even been a chance to have our day in court on that, and we've got a wrong opinion on the books on a constitutional question that conflicts with another court of appeals addressed the same issue.
But that kind of troubles, you know, it's a little troubling that our answer on what I think is a difficult constitutional question is not going to make any difference in the case, or might not.
Well, it'll certainly, I think it will make a difference in the case, but certainly it's going to help every other county and every other law enforcement officer, because we have to resolve this conflict sooner or later. But certainly, the evidence is pretty clear that the causation was linked up. The judge made some, Judge Mahaffey, in all due respect, made some evidentiary rulings that I think will have to be gotten to, and which we begged the Court of Appeals, of course, to get to. But we're now here, not on our own accord. We didn't choose to be litigants.
As I recall, under the sheriff statutes, the sheriff has the right during the end of each term or the beginning of each new term to fire all the deputy sheriffs and hire new ones if he wants to.
Absolutely.
With regard to constables and deputy constables, the statutes for constables are not quite as clear about whether the constables can fire everybody and start afresh. They don't have the same scope or extent of authority in that regard as the sheriff statutes. Yet the constitutional provision talks about them all in the same breath. Should we be concerned, if we're going to address the constitutional issue, that the treatment of sheriffs and constables in this regard is the same? Because essentially what you're saying is the 52E payments can be cut off by just not reappointing the constable, the deputy constable.
Of course, anyone.
But there may not be an absolute right to do that. Well, may or may not be.
Well, that's correct. And, for example, as the court knows, I bet David Brooks, the person who wrote the treatise on county and special government law, says actually it's the other way around. Says sheriffs, deputy sheriffs, are the ones who are most entitled to 52E payments till the end of their term. And so, and that's in the treatise, County Government Law 20.17 at page 134. So I agree in the sense, I think we're in a stronger position than constables, and if a court is saying we want the narrowest possible constitutional issue we're going to take, and if this case involves sheriffs, we'll decide sheriffs, and maybe or maybe not constables are a different KOF, kettle of fish, we'll decide that another day, that's not before us, then who's to argue? But I do think it's the same general theory, and certainly the treatise writers and Braden point this out, that everybody seems to be in a very similar position, if not identical. The language, then, of course, does not include the red. They want the red language. They want something that says the term of office is not the general tenure, as Brooks points out, but the first term of office in which the hospitalization or incapacity occurs. If you use it in that first term, so to speak, even though this was not Van Devender's first term, he'd been there 16 years, but the first time that you use this for your hospitalization or incapacity, if you're shot, injured, need some hospitalization, then you've used it, and that's the end of the term, and that's the only term you get. They want the red exclusion language, which is conceivably possible, but it's not in the Constitution. In addition to the text, there's three other sort of arguments that we need to look at based upon the legislative and the voter record, and we've already covered one, this idea of the compassion and the choice. The second one is the ballot language. The ballot language in this situation clearly does not explain it to the voters as to what they're actually voting on the county's way. It doesn't show any indication that this is a one-term limit. As you all know, what they want is a four-year cap. You only get these benefits once. If you get injured on January 1st, it's an absolute maximum four-year cap. That's the most we're ever going to get paid.
Who drafted the ballot language?
I believe the Legislative Council with the Secretary of State, but that's not in any of the material that's been submitted in the record. It's not, of course, the same language in the Senate Joint Resolution bill analysis. But it clearly does not key this into the singular. It says, states the opposite. Benefits are limited to the employee's terms of office. Why would that be? Well, everyone agrees that this was a workers' compensation provision to provide workers' compensation-like benefits at a time when there was no workers' comp for these employees. And so all the legislative history and the ballot and the bill analysis show the primary intent is to give a pro-law enforcement benefit in two respects. Number one, it's supposed to help injured officers in their time of need when the financial effects may be insurmountable, according to the legislative analysis. And secondly, it's a recruiting tool. It's a way to make sure that law enforcement has people coming into its ranks, even though it is so ultra-hazardous. And the legislative history which we've submitted shows that this was a dire need at the time. Why do I stress that? Because this court has expressly written and quoted recently that it is the intent at the time a constitutional amendment was enacted that controls, not how we look back at it now. And that's Kramer versus Shepard. The meaning of a constitutional provision is fixed when it is adopted, and it is not different at any subsequent time. It should be construed in the light of the conditions existing at the time of the adoption. And even though that's a 1940 case, both Justice Brister and Justice Hecht have cited Kramer recently. So even in hindsight, if we now say today, well, now we have workers' compensation, or we have other ways to recruit people into law enforcement, it does not change the focus, which was the amendment at the time. The language then clearly shows that this is not supposed to be, as we've already discussed, there's no pigs in the poke here. The medical benefits are such that if someone tragically is in a coma and has huge medical bills that are totally unforeseen, then they're not going to get those, right? The county has the election of deciding whether or not to pay those. There's no pig in the poke. There's no expenditure that cannot be booked.
Let me ask you this first before your time runs out. Back to Judge Hecht's question. What does it mean when the trial judge says causation is neither proved nor disproved? Does that mean didn't? The preponderance, can I read that to be the preponderance evidence? There was some evidence, but not preponderance?
We're on the knife edge, and no one's blown us over one way or another.
I've never heard of such a finding that evidence neither proved.
Exactly, exactly. And for what it's worth, the trial judge said he was reluctantly holding that. and you know he wouldn't have said that if he hadn't. So, my time is up.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Rudd will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. You've got to like a trial judge who reluctantly is compelled to a conclusion based on the evidence, even if he's willing to say so. These are recorded, right?
Yes.
I want to say before we get too far down the road that I love law enforcement people. I love all of them. They're important. They're important to elections. And I don't think the legislature's done near enough to provide them benefits in terms of what they do and what they provide for us. But let me respectfully suggest to the court that the issue is not whether or not a disability payment under 52E of the Constitution has to occur in the same term that an injury occurs. The question before the court is whether or not a person who has been injured in the course of employment and is law enforcement employment and then is paid a period of disability can then in subsequent terms rely upon that injury and disability payments that have occurred before to again draw disability payments. And let me tell you where I think that leads us to a problem. If we hold that, yes, in fact, he can, where that leads us is to a limitation provision in that constitutional provision that becomes meaningless. And here's how that happens. My sheriff is an elected official. And in Jefferson County, the law enforcement community is very close. They like one another. They rely upon each other. They know each other's spouses and children. Now, if I have an officer who's been injured in the course of his employment and rendered a paraplegic, and he's always going to be a paraplegic, and he's never going to be back in a patrol car, and he's never going to do those law enforcement functions for me again, and here I am as the elected sheriff, and now I am not only vested with the authority, but the responsibility to determine whether or not to re-deputize him for a new term, and I know if I don't, the economic consequences to him and his family are substantial. What do you think a politician's going to do under those circumstances? It's not going to bankrupt Jefferson County. We'll re-deputize him. 4 years from now, he's still in a wheelchair. He still can't perform law enforcement functions. I'm still the sheriff. He's a friend of mine. His wife or his spouse, they're friends of mine. Those children, I'm watching them grow up. What am I going to do when it comes time to make that re-deputizing decision again? I'm going to re-deputize him again. And then wherein is the end of that and where's the limit that clearly is expressed in the Constitution?
Isn't that up to the voters of Jefferson County, as opposing counsel says? If they want to keep electing that sheriff who keeps deputizing the paraplegic, isn't that their choice?
And what prevents the next sheriff from making the same choice?
Well, but isn't that Jefferson County's choice?
Can't the county commissioners say, you're not getting any more budget for that?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think they can. I don't think the county commissioners can abrogate a constitutional right. If the sheriff has the authority to confer that benefit on a deputy, I don't think the county commissioners have the authority to take that away simply by saying we're not going to fund it.
But I've found over the years that the commissioner's court can be very creative in bringing pressure to bear.
I've noticed that myself.
On officials to get done what they want done. And it seems to me that if that were the wrong decision, the county has plenty of pressure to make sure the sheriff doesn't do that.
Yeah, and I agree. They can bring pressure. They can simply say, well we're going to fund one less law enforcement position for you because you've chosen to take a law enforcement position and award it to somebody who can't perform those functions. And that sounds like maybe that's real enough to pressure on the sheriff. But guess what? Those same law enforcement people don't just vote in sheriff's races. They vote in commissioner's court races and county judges' races. They can be very influential in that. And so I'm not sure that's realistic to say that those pressures can be brought to bear. But the real problem is what the Constitution has conferred here is a right on somebody and the ability to collect that right, my right to receive that benefit payment, is now dependent upon the right or wrong whim or decision of another elected official. So that while in Jefferson County, that right might very well be one that goes on for term after term after term, whereas in the neighboring county, where the sheriff isn't, for whatever reason, doesn't have quite the same philosophy, may say, no, I need a person who can be on the street. I'm not redeputizing you.
But I hear you.
People situated exactly the same situation, relying on the same constitutional provisions, have different results.
So in your view, the purpose of the constitutional language is to get the sheriff out of this quandary and protect the county fisc?
No, I don't believe it's to get the sheriff out of the quandary. The point is that when the provision was enacted, there was a limit. All right? Now, the limit, if we can understand that the people understood anything about benefits provided to employees, they understood workers' compensation as it existed back then, which was a maximum 401-week benefit from the date of injury, regardless when the disability manifested itself. And regardless of how unfair that result was, there was an ending date, and a certain ending date. And I think consistent with that, with what was known about the framework of the law as it existed at the time this constitutional provision was enacted, the voters must have thought, the legislature must have thought, we're putting in an end date. End dates are always arbitrary and always unfair to somebody, but it's an ending date. And so it seems to me that the ending date in a proper construction of this statute is it ends when the term ends where the disability is running.
Where does workers' comp end? If he's relegated to workers' comp, when would his benefit end, or does that go on?
Well, his workers' compensation benefit has nothing to do with the term of office.
And so it continues beyond the term of office?
Sure. Or beyond the date of termination of employment. Workers' compensation benefits are not dependent on that.
So if the purpose of the provision was to mirror a workers' comp sort of scheme where benefits will continue, then how can we say that it should be interpreted to cut those benefits off?
Because at the time that this statute was enacted, there was an ending date to workers' compensation benefits. It wasn't related to term of employment, and it wasn't related to continued employment, but it had an ending date. It was not a lifelong scheme. It ended. And granted, it'd been a lot nicer if they'd given us better language to work with in terms of an ending, but what they've given us is a benefit, and I'm not sure it was ever intended to be interpreted this way, but they've given us a benefit that, depending on who your sheriff is, may end off, stop for one person and go on forever for another one, based upon the whim of a sheriff. There are no guiding principles, legal principles, for a sheriff to apply in making a decision that's going to have those kind of consequences. And it seems to me that would be a particularly unusual interpretation of a constitutional provision, to place a benefit in the hands of another person with no guiding principles for how it's to be decided. And if that's what it means, then aren't we necessarily putting ourselves in a position where if I'm the deputy whose benefit's been cut off, don't I have a legal right to come before the court and claim that decision is somehow arbitrary and capricious and I ought to be entitled to it? That the sheriff treated another deputy exactly in the opposite way because he was friends and I wasn't a friend with the sheriff? But where's the legal right created in this constitutional provision to make that kind of a challenge? That's where you go if we leave this to the discretion of the sheriff to decide whether or not this benefit continues or is not continued. So the construction, in terms of James Van Devender, if we decide that we can have interrupted periods of disability, then we've taken us exactly to that point that I'm talking about, where a sheriff now has to decide Do I confer this benefit on a friend and fellow law enforcement officer because the law allows me to do it? Or do I not confer it on this fellow officer who maybe is not such a good friend? I don't think we want to put the state of our jurisprudence in that sort of a position. So I'll agree with you. This is a tough one.
But Justice Johnson makes a good point. You know, there's a campaign could be run by an opponent of that sort of cronyism, right? And just say, you know, this is what this officer is doing, and we need officers who can perform the job, and those are the kind of officers I'm going to appoint. TV commercials, ads, et cetera, and the voters just decide that issue.
You bet.
Well, why isn't that the answer?
Because that's not, that is an answer. But is that the answer we want to have for a constitutional benefit that's in our Texas Constitution?
You started out policy, and I'm just responding on that. But I'm not talking about the text right now, but why isn't that the answer to that policy dilemma that you posed?
No, I agree. But again, we're at a place where a constitutional benefit now is not only dependent upon the decision of a sheriff, but on the political will of the electorate. And again, it seems to me that if this is a benefit conferred by the Constitution, we ought to be able to uniformly apply it to officers across the state without concern about how the political consequences of those things might fall.
Remind me, can sheriff fire the deputies at will?
Yes. In our county, yes.
So wouldn't that be... the question is, if you could fire them at will, would that be the end of their term, or would you have to keep paying them maximum salary?
I believe the end of their term is the term of the officer is coincident with it, the same as the term of the sheriff, and I don't think a termination interrupts that term or sets a different date for it.
Going to the text, can you point to any language, either in the current constitutional provision or the history of it, of the ballot and so forth, which would limit the benefit to the term in which the injury occurred?
No, and I don't think it's so limited. And maybe I didn't make myself clear starting out. I agree that's what the Court of Appeals opinion says, but that's the facts they were faced with. I think had the facts been the injury occurred in one term, but the disability started in a subsequent term, that then that would be the term where the disability or the hospitalization starts is the term where the benefit is paid, and it's the end of that term where the benefit stops. Now, that's not the facts of our case.
Right, but okay, where's the language to support that argument?
Well, I just think, to tell you that it's clearly there either way, I can't tell you that. That's the ambiguity of the constitutional provision we're dealing with. I don't think anyone can stand here and tell you, oh, here it is. That's why we're here.
Well, on the face of it, it doesn't appear to me to limit it to that. And we would have to read it into the provision, wouldn't we?
It clearly says it expires at the end of the term which he's appointed, so I'm not sure.
Well,
the problem we're all having is what term are we talking about? I understand that.
What weight should we give the ballot language? If this is an ambiguous term, shouldn't we give the language that the voters voted on some deference?
Well, my problem with ballot language is that often is not a direct quote of what is ultimately going to be in the Constitution. The ballot language is usually somebody's interpretation of what that constitutional provision means.
But if we're struggling with an ambiguous term, shouldn't the language the voters voted on carry some weight?
Well, I agree the language the voters voted on should have some weight because that is some indication of what they thought they were voting on.
Should we presume they read the papers and knew what the actual provision is?
Well, and if they read the papers, then according to the Austin American Statesman, they thought this benefit was in fact optional when clearly it was couched in mandatory language. So I guess the Austin American Statesman didn't understand it either. So I don't know that provides us a lot of useful guidance in terms of what I can see. It's a difficult issue.
Mr. Rugg, let me change gears just a moment. There's some discussion about at the origin of this that a county could not pay salary we call to an incapacitated officer. Is there some provision in your county at this point that if the officer is incapacitated, they can? Or, and the reason I'm wondering is this, it seems like this might put the counties kind of on a, in a quandary, because if there's no authorization for them to pay, for example, your county paid beyond and then decided not to pay, did it have authorization to actually pay if it went beyond the term that you're arguing for here, which was the first term?
Yeah,
or is that a
no,
gift or of public funds? And the reason I ask that is we got to know whether to try to decide this or send it back or what to do with it. But it seems like the counties may have a problem on this.
You know, that was an issue that came up in the early stages of this whole matter when it first came to my attention that we were paying James Van Devender into a different term of office than the disability first looked at. That was when they came to me and wanted to know, are we doing the right thing, not doing the right thing?
You don't have to tell us your attorney-client conversation unless you want to.
It's not that big a deal and not that privileged. My understanding of the constitutional provision that I came to then with very little guidance is the same as it is today. I believe the language compelled the conclusion that when a disability payment started in one term, when that term of office ended, that disability payment ended. That subsequent disability periods, whenever they occurred, related back to that original injury, didn't give rise to another payment. So, and yeah, we voluntarily overpaid some 14 months worth of
that. And did the county have authority to do that with public funds?
I think not.
And that's why it stopped. The conclusion at that point was, we can't.
When I, as the county's attorney, advised them that I thought those payments were not authorized, they stopped.
And so that's the situation at this point. Unless there's some authority somewhere else, a county that does pay is guessing about whether they have the authority to do that with public funds or not.
And I think that's why this is an important issue for this court. Clearly, whichever way we decide on this particular issue, this particular case has got to go back to the Court of Appeals for a determination of the factual issues on causation. I think everybody's clear on that. But in terms of how do the other counties in this, how does Jefferson County and all the other counties of this state administer this provision, it is a question that needs to be resolved and a difficult question to resolve. Because I think there are good arguments to be made on both sides of the issue and frankly don't envy the court in making a decision, but it's where it is. I think we put ourselves, if we go on to what the petitioner wants this court to do, then we put ourselves in exactly that quandary I'm talking about, where we have a constitutional right that will be dissimilarly administered across the state depending on a sheriff's sensibilities to budget needs or sensibilities to the law enforcement community. And I think that not a good place to place a constitutional right.
Could a county authorize this type of payments? Is there some way that a county could on its own authorize this type of payment of its own funds?
You know, I think that probably those counties that have labor agreements, and we are one, with its law enforcement officers, that is a benefit of employment that could possibly be negotiated into a labor agreement. I think otherwise you're standing on other constitutional prohibitions that prohibit the gift of public funds, and that's where this whole issue came from in the first instance, was because of those other constitutional provisions. If there are no other questions, thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Sir, to answer the original hypothetical that Mr. Rubb posed, you have a beloved officer who's injured and the time for reappointment comes and maybe prompted by sympathy or whatever, he's reappointed. Putting aside the political pressure and how that might be brought to bear to kind of combat that, is there any kind of legal prohibition to that?
Well,
I think we've just heard about how the hard-ass county attorney comes in and says, no, you can't spend money on this. I don't care how much you like them or dislike them. So there are legal checks, and, of course, we've discussed commissioners' courts. But the true nature of it in this simple hypothetical is that cronyism is the only reason we're making a decision to keep someone on or not. You would think somewhere in that mix is, can the person do the job? Is there some job they can do? What's the benefit they're going to be offering the taxpayers?
Assuming they can't do the job, does 52E permit those payments in perpetuity?
No, it's never in perpetuity. It's only as long as a sheriff affirmatively grants the right to reappoint someone, which is in his total discretion. If a sheriff was totally standardless and was just going to keep someone on, then as we've said, that's a democracy issue. But it's not a constitutional interpretation because the language is what we are drawn back to.
Let me have your view on what would happen if the term was interrupted, if it wasn't a successive term.
A successive term of office or successive injury?
Successive term of office.
So
he was injured, suffered, just like this case, except that instead of being reappointed, the time passes, say, 4 years. He's not reappointed. Then he is reappointed for another term, and the incapacity manifests itself again.
Of course, that's not this case, right. But I would think then if they are serving, you would march through the three clauses of the Constitution. Clause 1, is that truly related to the first on-the-job injury? Yes. Then Clause 2, you would then get, if there's a true period of hospitalization or incapacity, you'd get it. Clause 3 ends at the end of that term of office. You just got to march with the language. I would like to sort of use my time, though, to also come back to this issue of this gives us too many choices. There's just too many whims here, and there's sort of three sub-arguments here. Number one, this idea of we can't have the sheriff making standardless decisions or the county making standardless decisions. Well, the medical benefit section, Clause 1, is totally optional. The county can make any kind of decision there, yay or nay, to pay hospital benefits, and that's within their discretion according to the Constitution. They can decide it for whatever reason. You would figure cost and cost effectiveness are a factor, but it is standardless, and we all agree that's what that means. Second, county versus county disparity. Well, that's what the election of counties and local control is. Some counties are going to have sheriffs that will fire people if there's one auto accident, and some will keep someone on for whatever reason. There are going to be variances in how elected officials in counties, thank goodness, conduct their business, checked by the voters. But the real argument is this idea of the whim, and a county sheriff is going to have the whim to construe constitutional benefits for a longer period of time. But isn't that the case with all fringe benefits? You get more fringe benefits of your job the longer you're associated with your employee, which means two things. First of all, I like the table-pounding sound of, you don't think we can't have weapons and uniforms being conveyed on the whim of a sheriff, but when you turn that around, we convey those items to people based upon the sheriff's decision to hire them or reappoint them.
What about the argument that you could create a perceived right to some deputy that was terminated because of a disability or for whatever reason?
Well, I'm not sure how that would play out. If someone was terminated, not because they're getting workers' comp benefits, but because I just don't want to pay that extra juice, the extra difference, because the salary says maximum salary, and that's the part I'm objecting to, I don't think that would be a workers' comp retaliation case. I don't see how that officer would have any relief, given at least the existing case law, Wyland is still pending, as to the total amount of discretion that a sheriff or constable has to fire people at the end of their term. And so I don't see that that's what it's going to affect. But that's a static concern for workers' comp, because they're getting workers' comp anyway. But I don't think that would influence the sheriff's decision one way or another. And so if a sheriff exercises discretion to keep someone on, then that person, again, there's no pigs in the poke. They are only obligated to pay for the time they've authorized to employ the person.
Any further questions? Thank you, Councilor.